forget the first moment when I walked in Cure Cinema. I was hooked from there on.
Hello and welcome to the 14th Revived Scanon Podcast. I'm Darren Mooney, sitting in for Niall Murphy, and joining me are...
Jay Kyle.
And Ronan Doyle, hello.
And this week we'll be discussing the week in film, Irish and otherwise. But let's start with what we normally start with, which is what we watched this week. So Ronan, what have you watched in the past week?
I had a very good week at the cinema. I had Phantom Thread on 70mm, which was quite an experience. The IFI had it for three screenings only. And I distinctly remember going to see it on 35 and absolutely adoring. I think, you know, obviously the theatrical experience with 35 is incredible. But in terms of the film itself, thinking, I really want to see this again, but I want to have some breathing space. It's the kind of film that, you know, some films you go back to almost immediately because the shift in perspective informs your subsequent viewing. With this, obviously, you would get that too, but I wanted a little distance, you know, to sort of evaluate it from a fresh perspective. So it's great to see it. It was brought back a couple months later. I think it came out February 1st.
I think they hit all the formats as well, I believe.
Yeah. It's being accepted. I didn't actually see it in digital myself. It is wonderful in 70. Obviously, it's blown up. It was shot 35. It's a different look. And it's kind of extra granular, which is really interesting for the kind of tactile nature of it. You know, obviously it's concerned with surfaces and the dresses,
the fabric, material.
Absolutely. And it's really beautiful to see in 70. I think maybe 35 as it was shot is the better way, in that it's more... everything feels more natural. 70.
Well, it was designed for it.
Yeah, of course. 70 is almost too granular, but it was a terrific experience, and you also get that incredible boost to the sound. It's just that bit louder.
Will we see? I have a feeling we've got to see probably all of Anderson's films blown up in that way. They seem to be.
Yeah, I wonder.
Seem to get a bit of a run in that regard.
Yeah, and the Master did very well on 70.
Yeah, exactly.
On 70 screenings. The Lighthouse had their 35 season recently, and everything looked absolutely glorious. As to whether they get blown up in 70, I don't know. I'd certainly be first in line anyway. It was an incredible experience. And to revisit the film was great with that bit of distance. It's hilariously funny.
It is. It's a very dry comedy.
It's fantastic. And to see it with the knowledge of everything that happens and revisiting
Where it's going.
It's really, really interesting. And it really holds up to a second viewing. You know, there's no sense of waiting for the best bits, any of that kind of thing.
I liked it when I saw it, but I was very aware that a second viewing would be necessary. You imagine.
That tends to be the way with Anderson.
I do agree with that. It does take a little while to settle, and you always feel you've probably missed quite a bit on first watch because you're kind of following it, probably staring at it too intently in some ways, and you just tend to.
As opposed to letting it wash over.
Which is a good second view and better experience in that regard. You're concerned with plot to some.
And that's kind of indicative of his interest in human relationships, that they're really complex, that you don't understand what's happening. Hindsight is such a benefit. So to go back to these things is fantastic. I also saw a 35mm double bill at the Lighthouse with the Hollywood Babylon Midnight Film Club.
Nice.
Which I saw Poltergeist with them last month, which was absolutely terrific. A battered old print from the 80s that was tinged pink at this point.
I love those old prints.
Beautiful. Maybe not the best way to see it for the first time, as a lot of people in the crowd did, but it really gets you back to this idea of cinema as a communal experience. And this battered print that has been looked at by audiences for literally 35 years.
That's had its own journey.
Absolutely. So this month they did a double bill of Cat People and Kiss Me Deadly.
Which I was really hoping to see, but I was away for the weekend. I picked a weekend to miss all Phantom Threads.
A great celluloid weekend. Well, Jason.
What Jay watched this week is going to be very interesting.
Yes. Oh, it is. It was great, really, really good double bill. I'd seen Kiss Me Deadly before, great to see it again on the big screen, and I'm kind of glad that they put that second because it has more of a sort of midnight paranoiac feel about it almost. Cat People, which I hadn't seen before, absolutely loved.
Beautiful. I haven't seen it either. It's a terrific film.
It's one of these sort of really strange golden age Hollywood horrors that does some really interesting things with sexuality and otherness. It's very much of its time in the way it projects its ideas of feral sexuality onto another. You know, it's a Serbian character who is positioned as this sexual other. But it sets up a really interesting dynamic between sort of romantic attraction, sexual attraction, emotional attraction, and, where do they come together? Yeah. Where do they diverge? Is it sensible to have one person as the locus of both of these things? It's really interesting, doing some great things, and technically absolutely beautiful. One thing I will say is that the print had some dodgy sound quality at, like, the key sequence.
Ah, okay.
I was just looking at it for the first time. Can't believe this is happening. This would be still incredible to look at, but the sound was ruined at a very, very important point for sound, which is a little bit heartbreaking.
Worth
such is
noting,
the nature of these things.
I think that there was a Criterion edition of Cat People released recently as well, worth seeing.
I wonder if that's on Filmstruck, who I may or may not have been able
procured
to
procure. Jay cannot neither confirm nor deny the existence
of the Filmstruck account.
Yes, yeah. In his name. And also, I remember Val Lewton being subject of the early You Must Remember This podcast.
That's true, isn't it?
As
yeah.
Well. So they're very worth a listen as well in that respect.
And the only other thing I'll highlight is Custody, which was out last week. I went along to see, and is really, really good. It's the French drama about separating parents and the children caught between.
Yeah, this sounds great.
It's really interesting. It's got such confident direction for a debut. I think the plot is expanded out of a short from the director, and it's really interesting how it plays around with genre. It opens with quite a long sequence. It's about 10 minutes of a custody hearing for the two parents, shot in sort of medium shot. It seems to set itself up to be relatively quiet drama, and then elevates into strange domestic horror territory that's unexpected yet inevitable, and it amplifies this idea of the dissolution of a family into genre tropes in a way that's beautifully handled. I was really, really impressed by it. There are a couple of curious directorial choices in the third act that sort of took me away from what would otherwise have been nearly unbearable tension.
But necessary, possibly.
I think there were moments where I was taken out of the film. I thought, why have you cut to that? That's a poor choice. But otherwise, really, really impressed the way it communicates the difficulty for all members of the family of dealing with this kind of thing. Really, really good.
It's one I'm hoping to catch next week. I know it's still running next week, so hoping to catch it early next week. I'm going to report back.
Cool. So, Jay. I know you got a lot of stuff done this week. So
yes.
What did you watch and what were you going to talk about?
Right, so I've been away for most of the week. So in that regard, other than missing an absolute smorgasbord of 35 mil and 70 millimeter films on the weekend, I on my travels, I managed to catch one film. So I've watched one film this week, which seems extraordinary, like that I don't have weeks at all time, but then all I do is watch films, which is tragic and brilliant at the same time. The film I watched was Bridget Jones Story.
Uh-huh.
Who had the better weekend, really, is the question here.
I'm going to say Ronan.
I don't know, you spent a lot of time eating well in Cork.
I did.
It's a pretty good trade-off.
It is. Bridget Jones Story is a really, really odd film in that it's one of those films that I've been aware of since it came out, right? Which is, just checking, it's 2001. I've seen sections of it and scenes of it, but I've never watched the whole thing. Mm-hmm. But I probably know the whole plot pretty much.
It's Pride and Prejudice, basically. To the point where they hired Colin Firth.
And plays a Darcy character.
It's Pride and Prejudice, but Hugh Grant as the dodgy guy, Bingham. Who's the other guy?
Hugh Grant, yeah.
Yeah, no, I know, but who's in Pride and Prejudice?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know.
All right.
Sorry. I think I've read the Bridget Jones Story book actually when it came out, but I can't remember anymore. It's been that long. But anyway, I was aware of the film, so I was like, I must actually watch it because I had like five channels and I wasn't on it.
Yeah.
And it was like on. So I was like, I'll watch it. And
that's replicating the full 2001 watching experience.
Yeah, exactly. it's really interesting. It's not very good, but it has things in it that are very good. Like, Zellweger is amazing.
Yeah.
Mm. Like, she's really, really good and carries the film through real trust. like the real pro she is. She's excellent. Her timing is impeccable. Her accent's impeccable. The idea of that's what passed for somebody that's really overweight is astonishing.
That's absurd,
age. Like, she looks great.
Yeah.
Like, what the
she hell? Looks healthy.
Yeah, she does. Yeah.
She looks healthier compared to what Renee Zellweger normally looks like.
Discussed this online then with Grace, I think, and somebody else, I can't recall it, Becky, I think, and we were saying that I felt really dated in the way that certain films are. And I think it's true when Grace mentioned that. And you get it with like zeitgeist films and kind of, you know, films that kind of
divine their
era. Yeah. And then once their time has passed, they're curious kind of relics in a way, like that thing. Now, they were saying that the second one has dated even worse now. I've seen the second part, it's really bad.
I don't think it's awful, but I think it's dated more.
Yeah, okay. And this one had that unfortunate kind of Richard Curtis vibe of, you know, that middle class kind of smugness that radiates off people.
Oh, we're so clever.
Yeah, I know. Oh, that's not tomorrow morning. That kind of thing. It's really exhausting. I reached my Richard Curtis kind of line a long time ago where it's like, I can't watch any more of these films, they're unwatchable. And this has that vibe of it.
Okay, to be clear, we're not talking about the about time threshold where
nobody uses about time to commit sexual assault in this film.
Right, just so we're clear.
I'm sure there's worse films in the world than the about time ever.
But Jay,
at this moment in time, it's the worst film I have ever seen.
Wow.
Ever seen.
We saw All About Eve together, right, Jay?
Yeah. Mm. Yes. Mm-hmm. That about time makes All About Eve look like Dog Day Afternoon.
Stop.
It's not at least not like, listen, Driver Producer, it's really bad. So this has a bit of a vibe of that. It's not as bad because it has Zellweger, and the Grant Firth kind of fight is kind of amazing. It's terrible.
It's absurd.
But that kind of works. So there are moments in it. It gets you to the end line that's kind of like Grant.
And it gives you sort of second stage Grant, if I remember correctly. It's the point at which Grant begins leaning into
He starts turning into the role that eventually played in Paddington 2.
Pirates, exactly. The point at which Grant seems to accept that he will never be a romantic leading
guy. No, he's now the kind of...
He's the other guy.
But he's never been a better other guy.
It's okay.
Like, it's not a great film. It has real problems, and I'm really patting this out because it's the only thing I've seen. But Zellweger is terrific, and it's worth seeing that alone. And that alone.
Perfect.
I'll skip the sequel. I heard the third one's good, though.
I haven't seen the third one yet. Yeah. It was a phenomenal hit last year.
It was expected to be made in that regard. And it made a fortune.
My extended family went to the cinema to see it, which is like, that's the bell of bellwether, pretty much. Darren's family know this movie exists, therefore it is
it's going
to
make trillions.
If it can permeate that deep into consciousness.
No, you're probably right. I will try to cast the third one. I'm not going to watch the second. But not.
But how will we make sense of it, Jay? The tight continuity that exists in the series.
Thankfully, Wikipedia exists, Darren.
All right. I did a bunch of film watching this week to help make up for Jay's.
Thank you. I'm really glad.
I was publicly shamed last week with Letterboxd when people began listing the films on Letterboxd over the past 10 years that were most popular they hadn't seen.
Yes.
Number of very secret shames were laid bare there, so I made a point to go out and see the film on the list which I was most disappointed to have missed. It Comes at Night, which was last year's most popular film that I missed. I know you guys were waiting for Martyrs.
Yeah, we really were.
I really, really was hoping it. But
I want to see what happens when we feed you Martyrs.
Feed me Martyrs.
Me too. I cannot wait for that podcast.
But anyway, It Comes at Night, which was the movie last year. It was directed by Trey Edward Schultz.
Yes.
His second film, I believe.
He made also a one-word film, which is really...
Krisha.
Which is really good, and I think gets extra stars because it's like 72 minutes long.
This one's on 91, Jay, so you know, I think this is still within your top.
I've seen this also.
You've seen this, huh?
I have, yeah.
I liked it quite a bit, I have to say. I wasn't in love with it. I thought it was too abstract, too vague, too sort of self-aware in some places.
Yeah.
A little bit too canny. One of those horror movies that's about horror more than featuring horror, if that makes sense. It unfolds in a distant future where some sort of plague has wiped out most of humanity, and it's about trying to protect a family, led by Joel Edgerton. And it's basically trying to protect his family when this other family come in. You've got this tension, and it turns out, without getting too spoilery, the It Comes at Night refers to the concept of fear and terror, which is a nice thing to do, and it's a very clever concept. And the film, for 90 minutes, sort of like stretches that quite thin, surprisingly thin. There's a lot of great stuff in here.
Mm-hmm.
Schultz is a fantastic director. There's a lot of really rich visuals, really nice lighting, really nice design. He does a thing which is very canny, and I'm not sure if... he's talked about in interviews about how He hopes you don't notice it, but I suspect that the kind of people who are going to be on this podcast will notice it, which is that he narrows the aspect ratio repeatedly throughout the film at several points, particularly where tension is building in order to create a sense of claustrophobia. And it works very well up until the point where you realize it's happening.
Yeah.
And at that point, you start to feel a little game.
Does he do that Xavier Dolan thing of literally you can see it narrowing or that it just switches? Okay.
You can see it narrowing, and he does at several points cut through black. But even in the black, because the black that's captured on film is not actually black, you can see the lines being sort of pushed in. And it works well in places, but at other points it feels almost too clever.
I agree with you. I'd agree with that. I probably didn't like it as much as you did. I did like it. But there's a lot of atmosphere, a lot of tension.
Yeah.
The cast are pretty great. And I like that. It doesn't give too much away in any real sense, or it doesn't really feel the need to kind of feed you anything.
It feels very much a Shostakovich as an influence, like the original Night of the Living Dead, in that it's a very broad horror film. In that, like, and particularly when you look at Night of the Living Dead, as much as established about, you know, it's the first zombie movie, it doesn't really give you that much to go on at the time. It's like, the dead are risen. Deal with it.
Yeah.
And this is like, everybody's dead. Deal with it. But I really, really like the sense of tension and the camera pushing. And there's also really nice sort of oppressive. It's got this really rich, oppressive atmosphere. It's very, very good.
I remember watching it, and I remember kind of talking on Twitter about that. It reminded me of a film which I think is a better film personally, which is Conor Horgan's 100 Mornings, which has not similar in the sense of it's coming at the end of the world from a different perspective, I guess. In the sense that, you know, it kind of certainly touches upon the idea that something has happened in a very real way, and that these people are hunkering down for whatever reason. And 100 Mornings does that similar thing, but it's kind of, it does it with like, what would happen if the world ended on a real whimper?
Mm-hmm.
And you had this kind of deadpan, quiet, let's sort out the basic kind of things. And I, as films work, and I think you're right about the kind of aspect ratios and stuff, I think he has problems in this film, and it comes like burying the kind of
the director's hand.
Yes, exactly. It's not bad, and it's
a very fine director's hand. You can appreciate the artistry, but it just doesn't necessarily work emotionally.
Once you realize something, I think you're right. The jig is up a little bit,
yeah.
And it pulls attention from it a little bit as well.
Like you can appreciate the art and the technique of it, but in terms of as a horror movie, it doesn't necessarily that. I liked it a great deal, to be fair.
Well, I would heartily recommend Krisha, which is absolutely superb. It's about a mother coming to her family's, where something that's clearly happened in the past, where she's visiting the kind of her kids and extended family's home for Thanksgiving. And it stays mostly from her perspective in terms of how she sees the family, and she's not walking on eggshells, they're walking on eggshells. And it's this tremendous lead performance, and maybe even by the director's mother or a friend that somewhere living in the hometown. Yeah. The film costs nothing to make. And it basically just kind of spends a couple of days where she's there and the family, and it gently ratchets up the kind of tension within that in a kind of similar way, but in a very different kind of tone. And it's brilliant. I really, really like that. And I much preferred it to It Comes at Night, but he's certainly a director worth watching.
And I also watched, because I wanted another horror buzz afterwards, I watched Veronica, directed by Paco Plaza. This is the one that was quietly released on Netflix a couple of weeks ago.
There are people talking about it. I haven't seen it.
This is where basically I was feeling old, because I was in conversation with my little sister, who's going through a bit of a horror phase at the moment.
And excellent.
I recommended, because she likes light poppy horrors, I recommended A Happy Death Day. And I pitched it to her as Groundhog Day meets Scream. And there was just this awkward, like, blank look of response. And I was like,
What are they, you don't know
what Groundhog Day is? And she responded, I don't know what Scream is.
Oh, gosh.
I felt very, very old. So I asked her for a recommendation of a horror film that she liked, that she responded to. And she pointed me in the direction of Veronica.
Okay.
And I did a bit of research online. This thing was massive when it landed. And I mean, it's interesting because, you know, people talk about Netflix burying content. This is something that they released with no announcement, no prior press. This is basically the best case scenario for something like The Cloverfield Paradox, where it landed, it got positive reviews, it got great word of mouth, and everybody loved it and recommended it. People were describing it as the scariest experience they've ever had, unable to watch it to the very end. So I was like, oh, this is going to be great.
That's young people, eh?
Is this Netflix acquisition or production?
This is a Netflix acquisition.
I think it is, yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, so I was very, very excited about it. It is, for anybody who's not familiar with it, based on the Spanish equivalent of the Enfield Horror or the Amityville Horror, in that it is a relatively well, inverted commas, documented story of possession and demonic involvement. In this case, it was inspired by a police report, which actually documented several bizarre occurrences in the region of the house. So it sort of it has that sort of rich lived-in atmosphere.
Okay.
It's not the scariest film you've ever seen by a considerable distance. It is nowhere near that. It's very effective. Plaza, who obviously directed Wreck, he knows how to frame a shot. He can make the film look beautiful. It's full of wonderful compositions. It's got really great moments, really wonderful choices. But they're mostly choices, interesting enough, that aren't scary. So choices like capturing a sense of foreboding rather than a sense of horror, or capturing a sense of like slowly creeping dread more than shock.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's very much in the style of the recent like revival sort of 70s horrors, in the style of like Insidious or Sinister, or even say The Conjuring. It's got this thing where it's got a demon haunting this family, but it shows far too much of the demon, particularly as you get towards the climax, and so it kind of chips its hand and stuff. It was good. I enjoyed it. It was well made. It was not the scariest film I've ever seen. I never felt tempted to turn it off, and I slept perfectly sound afterwards.
But it's not the case with like 98% of horror films.
It is indeed. No, it's just the reaction to this.
Yeah,
not being interested.
But I remember that reaction, and this is going back to old Grandpa Jay's.
Grumpy Jay!
when this is pre-internet, right? So how word of mouth builds up and how long you have to wait for a film to come to Ireland, like 6-8 months after it was released in the States, sometimes a year. The build-up for when Silence of the Lambs came out. And Silence of the Lambs came out, there was articles, I remember a middle page in the Evening Herald saying people were fainting because of Anthony Hopkins' performance and had to be carried from the cinemas in America and all this kind of stuff. So when this came out, the cinema was like, oh, holy crap, this kind of is getting it. I really like Silence of the Lambs, it's great fun. But it, like, Anthony Hopkins' performance is hammy as all hell. Like,
that's
sorry.
The joy of it.
No, but like, my point is, it's not scary in any way, shape, or form. At all.
It's unsettling. Not his performance.
This is films unsettling, because Demi's a fine filmmaker. It's I remember watching it. And I watched that, like, I don't know what age it was.
I just had this image.
I was just like, Americans are idiots.
But that's kind of a factor of the studio deciding to sell it as a horror. And with a horror, you need to either go, this is based on real events, or this is terrified.
Obviously, the marketing department were doing the whole people are class. But that was in an innocent time where we literally believed people were clamps and everywhere.
But I love the image of Jay sitting in Savoy 1 in 1992.
I'm out.
The moment where Lecter cuts off a guy's face and wears it, Jay sitting in the front row going,
that's not what happened.
Check out this guy.
I had watched a significant amount of horror before I'd seen that, ages, you know. So this is like, it's fun. It's great fun. So.
And I would agree.
I would not laugh at wearing that somebody's face. That's the line.
But yeah, I laughed a great deal at the TV show Hannibal, and I probably shouldn't have. And I loved it. Fantastic TV show. And then I also watched The Grand Budapest Hotel at the weekend, which is great. Wonderful film. Still holds up very, very well. Probably Anderson's best.
Yeah, I'm inclined to think it might be.
Jay's feeling grumpy.
He's getting upset.
Jay was sitting in Savoy 1 going, check out this guy!
It would be up there, I think. Probably certainly top 5, but...
He's made 8.
Yeah, that's top 5 is pretty good, then. It's like, you're in the... I'll go top 4 for 50%.
Passing grade.
I'd be real telling off somebody, but I really, really like Grand Budapest Hotel. Really like it. Yeah. Probably second or third. Probably third.
And it's such a confectionery film, and it's very clever, it's very well constructed, it moves like the Clappers, which is fantastic. It's just beautiful.
And has the gift that is Ralph Fiennes.
I know.
Who seems to be having more fun than anyone has ever had in any job ever.
Comedic actor like
this. Yeah.
His timing is incredible.
You want to talk about a surprise? That was a surprise.
Yeah.
He sort of has this
public persona of being quite stiff, and despite the existence of things.
It's like
in
Bruges,
don't expect.
You're in an element of fucking up.
Even
after in Bruges, you don't expect him to be able to carry.
No,
like
I didn't think he'd be that light in the speed, I guess.
The public image of Ralph Fiennes is, you know, promoting career. Here's something I directed with my friend.
The Constant Gardener.
He's great. He can do a bit of everything. He's such a national treasure. Because when he turns up in something, Like, I'm always kind of happy. He generally doesn't seem to take on hack work. Like,
yeah.
You know, even if the film is quite boring, you know there's always going to be something in it worth watching. Usually his performance.
The slate is well considered.
Yeah, indeed, indeed, absolutely.
The film is always more worth watching for the fact that he's in it, which is
there's so much in that film, though. It's like the photon, the cat out the window,
there's also a little aside. Balances tone perfectly as well. Like the cat being thrown out the window is a great example. It's a scene that seems hilarious.
And then
you get the quick cut of the cat splattered across the table, which is like really shocking. And there's a lot of that through there as well, because it's basically about the rise of fascism.
Immense menacing things of Willem Dafoe and Jeff Goldblum.
I oddly found the film quite moving at the end. Which was kind of unexpected. I really like the kind of film within a film within a film.
The aspect ratio being used very cannily.
Very effectively.
Well, yeah, because it boxes it. Basically, it's like a package. It's like unwrapping a chocolate box. And then the colouring as well, the orange, and then you go to the pink. It's really, really nice. And again, great framing as well. Like, great use of the Academy ratio for making use of sort of space and people.
And faces,
Which is very, very...
What was the name of the painting again?
Boy with an apple.
Yeah. So much fun. That with Brody. Edgar Brody's so great.
I love the fact that it's built up like this thing you're never going to see. The standard language of cinema.
Yeah.
And then it's like, should we look at it? Let's go look at it.
And then the painting you replace it with.
Yeah.
And it takes a while to kind of twig it. And all.
It's great.
It's really good. There's lots of little touches like that. There's another little moment where Jude Law is remarking on how isolated and lonely F. Murray Abraham looks. And you see, this shot, this standard film composition shot of F. Murray Abraham sitting on the edge of the frame, and then the reaction shot of Jude Law, as if to say, well, if Jude Law were looking at F. Murray Abraham sitting at the corner of the frame, he wouldn't be at the corner of the frame. And there's a lot of that going on as well, which is very canny.
And Anderson's got a terrific understanding of star personas, and he uses them and inverts them constantly.
And he's very well used to kind of large ensemble talented cast in that way. Like, and
he juggles them
even, and particularly even small roles, stuff. People do great stuff. Like,
I think one of my friends has likened it to Anderson's filmmaking to a snowball, where once you get caught in it, you're not coming out. And it feels very much like that, because he talked about how when he was making the Grand Budapest Hotel, he literally just rang up everybody. He was like, "You want to be in my film?" The only person he couldn't get a hold of was Tom Wilkinson. He had to go through his agent. And apparently in the interview he was like, I feel like I'd have to do that again.
But the whole thing, like even that scenes where, you know, they ring up all the...
The Secret Society of the Keys.
Yeah. Which is basically just a reason just to bring all the actors.
Like Bob Balaban.
Exactly.
Bill Murray.
And I think it's completely not essential anyway. Like, it's great.
But again, it's the confectionery. It's the adult. It's so sweet.
This all just reminds me, I haven't seen Isle of Dogs yet, to my shame.
Yeah, I mean,
let's get on that, Ronan.
I think Ronan is wary because it may feature more cat-related slurs.
I've heard negative things about the portrayal of cats, which I'm not down for.
Otherwise it's perfect, though.
I will have no philinophobic films over here.
Alright, let's move on to talking about the week in film news. We should probably open with the recent passings of both Orly Ermey and Milos Forman. Two big losses at the start of the week.
It's crap start of the week, isn't it?
It really is.
Jesus.
And they happened in such quick succession as well, because I think Forman happened on Saturday, at least I heard about it on Sunday morning.
Yeah.
And Ermey happened, I think, on Sunday evening, Monday morning as well. And two gigantic figures.
I mean, Ermey's just become one of those kind of one role guys, hasn't he? To some degree.
Yeah.
Like, he's kind of, he's always got a variation on this.
So perfectly in Full Metal Jacket, like, he's so perfectly molded to that role and that persona that everything he's done since is defined in relation to that. Even, I think you pointed out on Twitter, one of your favourite Ermey moments.
There's a second moment where he just picks up his phone. It's not even my desk and just puts it back down again. It's like, no, I don't know. It's so beautifully timed, you know, and I really like it. It always stuck with me, man.
Yeah. A fantastic screen presence. And again, you're right, you've got stuck playing variation in that role. I think
he was fine with it as well, though. I think he did good fun with it.
He very clearly wanted to be an actor, to the point where he basically sabotaged his way into Full Metal Jacket, which is remarkable. But and Milos Forman as well, which is very
sad. I've seen a few Forman films, but I'm kind of woefully short on particularly his earlier stuff, which I haven't really seen.
Some of the non-English language stuff I haven't seen.
Yeah, same. I've
only seen the big four.
Yeah,
yeah, I'd probably the same. And it's kind of when somebody dies and you hear the outpouring, particularly from actors and people that have worked with him over the years, that like how kind of great he was for their careers and stuff, and how terrific a director he was, you realise, I probably should get on those.
Well, even when you think about the level of influence that he had, like in terms of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest being like one of the biggest films of 1975, the year that Jaws was released, sweeping the Oscars and becoming
one of my three to win the Big Five.
It's also one of the handful of films that can probably be wholly reconstructed from Simpsons clips along with Godfather. But I mean, that's the level. Everybody understands, like Nurse Ratched, everybody knows who a Nurse Ratched
is. Juicy Fruit. It's an astonishing cultural impact.
And again, same thing with Amadeus,
which is beloved.
But it's absolutely beloved. The Lighthouse are doing a screening of the director's cut, I think, this Sunday afternoon.
Unfortunately, I'm hiking on Sunday, so it won't be that.
But yeah, even Amadeus, which is kind of like a more esoterical film, is still, again, we were marking on our favourite sort of spoofs. 30 Rock doing it with a porn-based video game written by Tracy Morgan. Or Family Guy doing it with, when the family had to wear wigs. It's got this wonderful...
Like, the Dr. Zayas,
if you want to go further to Rock Me Amadeus, Falco basically building his entire rock career off an extended homage to it. Yeah, so it's astounding. And I mean, even then, if you look at the work he did in the 90s with, obviously, the other two big ones, Larry Flint and Man on the Moon as well.
Both good films.
Man on the Moon is tremendous.
Yeah.
And it's got a real resurgence of interest recently with that
documentary on Netflix.
But, Larry Flint's really interesting, actually.
I have a big soft spot for
him. Yeah, so anyway, it's well made, it's really well cast, and a really interesting story.
Harrelson, I think that was the one of the moments where I was like, Harrelson can bring the act. Because, I mean, after obviously Natural Born Killers, that felt very much like a stunt. That was like a look at me act, whereas Larry Flint felt more like.
Also, White Man Can't Jump, which is great fun.
Which one?
White Man Can't Jump.
Oh, yes. White Man Can't Jump is great.
It is. It's been a good few years since I've seen it. Yeah. But also EdTV, weirdly, which is...
That was late 90s.
That was the one the Truman Show wasn't.
Yes. Well, that was around the time
Ron Howard, this is what you get. But it's actually not bad, as these things go.
More Howard
Nash.
I will never miss a chance to attack the beige Ron Howard.
The beige Ron Howard.
Can't wait for the competent and standard solo movie to come out in a few weeks that robbed of Lord and Miller's ambition.
I am really, really waiting for the In Memorial for Ron Howard, where it's myself.
He was grand.
Jay's responses.
He made a lot of films that nobody particularly cared about.
Perfectly adequate.
Yeah,
I like Ron Howard.
I know you do, Dan.
Very good in Grand Theft Auto.
I don't know what to say to that.
I remember when they repackaged that to tie into the video game.
Did they?
In Sligo, at least in Sligo in the late 90s, there were pockets of DVD copies of this movie on sale in the local Extravision. With non-copyright infringing, but very clearly modeled fonts that were designed to...
That's good old Roger Corman just going, boom, more money.
Pays for the new house.
I can't fault him if you had that opportunity.
He's dead, right?
I feel like a lot of kids were very disappointed, though, somehow.
But anyway, sad minus form. Sorry about the Ron Howard detour. It's sad.
Alright then, so other news. The Irish Film Board has announced its funding decisions for the first quarter of the year.
Did I get in?
I'm going to open the envelope, Jay.
Let's do it.
Next year, I'm
going to...
Heartbroken.
My 100 million Countess Markovitz film will wait another year.
I would actually love to see
that. Me too.
Who are you casting? This is the question.
Leave Family.
I thought you were about to say Leave Schreiber.
Leave Schreiber?
That'd be kind of amazing. What a film. Only if Charlie Kaufman has directed it. I am knocked the hell out of that.
And there you heard it here.
There's
first.
A package right there. Let's get in next year.
There's your Irish Film Board funding for first quarter 2019.
Take that, Jim Sheridan.
Among those green lights include Mark O'Halloran's Trey Rialto, which is being produced by Marcy Films, got a €100,000 grant.
Good stuff.
It's great to see Mark more funding.
Yeah, and Cartoon Saloon's Puff and Rock, the animated TV show that's being distributed by Netflix internationally, got an additional $250,000 as well. And then a whole host of other stuff. There was $250,000 to both Svodica and Element Pictures for their upcoming projects. With the Horses being produced by Element, and America, which is Christine Leverings and Anders Thomas Jensen's film for Svodica.
Good stuff.
We're co-funding Jensen now. That's good.
And then documentary production, because I know Jay's interested in that. Gaza, Out of the Ordinary, got 100,000 euro.
I presume that's Gaza, as in political rather than footballer. Because they're in the... I'm just checking, because they're only getting the Gaza documentary. I'm assuming, like, you know, it's not podcasting.
The market there.
Yeah.
It'd be great if they did, like, a wrong footing sort of thing.
Or send Gaza to Gaza.
There we go. There's a...
Shit, man, I don't find...
Jay
I
is not
pitching.
That's like a Bravo TV series.
Yeah. I'm going to Galway. I'm pitching this shit.
Jay is all over the funding approval for 2019.
Guys, just
right
don't even apply anymore. I got this.
And Marcy Film Screamers got 125 grand as well. For Cine 4, the two projects were awarded 300,000 euro, which are Abu Media's Finky, which is written and directed by Dahi Keen and co-written by Jermaine DeVolta, and Macalito's Arakt, written and directed by Tambo Sando. Which is good.
That is good.
Cool. So, otherwise...
A nice funding allocation.
Yes, indeed. Good man.
Otherwise, the 19th Newport Beach Film Festival is doing an Irish vlog season.
Somebody should send me to the Newport Film Festival.
I could be
our guy on the ground.
Our man on the ground from inside the podcast.
I could do it, though.
I like
Newport
it.
Beach Film.
I'm waiting. I've metaphorically got my suitcase in hand.
I love the idea of sending Jay abroad at massive cost to the institution to cover films he's already seen here.
I would re-review them.
Yeah.
It's nice to see this happening across the world. There are a lot of... First of all, there are a lot of countries that now have Irish film festivals, as well as that, there are festivals that will have dedicated Irish seasons. The Transylvania Film Festival 3 years ago did an Irish season, and very regularly in their shadow short sections of horror films, they will include an Irish short, which is great because, you know, Irish horror actually has quite a strong
bite.
There are quite a lot of Irish filmmakers out there making short horrors. And it's good to see that recognized, especially in the land where Bram Stoker.
Well, it's exactly
that. There's that tie there.
And I mean, I suppose we'll be talking about one of those shorts extended to a feature film later on in the podcast as well, I suspect.
Mm-hmm.
But among the... They're premiering three Irish films over there. So Maze, The Drummer and the Keeper, and Michael Inside, which are all relatively good choices, actually.
Yeah.
Which is very good. That's their showcase film, so they're doing a sort of a screening in Edward's Big Newport, which is apparently where it is, and they're doing a celebration afterwards in Muldoon's Irish Pub. So if you're over there, you can get tickets for $25. I mean, I think
what
the budget...
Deal.
I bet say you travel
I'll,
to flight
I'll
accommodation...
I'll cover the tickets.
Okay.
If we
cover flights and accommodation.
Yeah, yeah. I've got that. Don't worry about it.
But they do. They also have international premieres of stuff like The Camino Voyage, Making the Grade, Kissing Candies, and Zoom.
I like Kissing Candies. I know that you weren't as enthralled.
I was not as hot on Kissing Candies as you were, but a lot of people seem to like it.
Yeah.
And if you're there, it's very worth sort of seeking out
if you have
a chance. In terms of other news that's happening, the Cineworld here in Dublin next week are opening Ireland's first 4DX cinema, time for Avengers Infinity War. So you can get yourself sprayed in the face with water and
smells. Is that really what it is?
Yes.
We were kind of joking about it online earlier on with Gavin Burke and John Byrne. I said, I'm going to skip the Gaspar Noé Love
screen. 3D experience.
For many reasons.
Be more pleasant than Nymphomania.
This is borderline idiotic, in my opinion.
Borderline.
I'm trying to be
nice. Well over the threshold here.
Like, this is absurd.
This is the stuff cinema tried in, like, the 50s.
Yeah, yeah.
When 3D didn't work the first time, it's like...
And 3D is kind of dying to death as well, isn't it?
Thankfully.
Yeah.
They're still continuing to bring things up, but I don't think it's getting much of a return anymore.
Like,
and notably, 2D screenings are much more common than 3D of films that are even released.
And they've stopped screening critic screenings in 3D as well. I think they've noticed as well.
I imagine they might get an extra star for that. But you made a point earlier on about that that's not the problem in cinemas. Like, the problems aren't that we don't have enough wang bang.
Stuff getting thrown in our face.
That is really
the
issue.
Nobody sits down watching Infinity War and goes, man, this is good.
Yeah.
But you know what I mean? I can't get water splashed in my face at key moments.
Yeah,
it's kind of just thinking about this. Like, the cinematic experience, because it is an experience you're packaging, but it's not that experience. It's not a 4DX experience. It's a, you know, get a babysitter for the kids, head into town, have a nice dinner, go and see a movie, have some popcorn, have a drink, enjoy and appreciate it. And that's the experience that cinemas should be selling.
Yeah.
And I think that a lot of people, and I don't want to generalize, But a lot of people today would recognize that that is not always the experience that you get when you buy a ticket.
Particularly in multiplexes.
Particularly in multiplexes.
Really
yeah. Particularly in, say, Cineworld, for example.
In Cineworld, you get 30 minutes of trailers.
Yeah.
I don't mind 30 minutes of trailers.
30 minutes is enough. I mean, 15 is my cap. If there are any more, I'm not going.
I went last night to go and see Love, Simon, which we'll talk about, obviously, in the top 10. But there were a good solid 15 minutes of Disney trailers beforehand, and I was like being swept off to Wonderland.
I suppose it's very important to me that they get the balance right, the trailers for films and
I would happily cut all the product stuff. I just want film stuff. I want, you know, Ewan McGregor, midlife crisis, verge of suicide, Christopher Robin confronted by Winnie the Pooh. I'm quite happy with that.
Yeah, that's fine, but it's not that. It's not only that, it's the no-wishers, it's the staffing,
it's the fact that, you know, you're in a cinema, you're surrounded by people who are talking loudly, who are checking their phones in a way that draws your attention away, that the projection booth isn't necessarily being manned, but isn't even being checked on.
Yes.
So you can have situations where sound is playing over a black screen for 5 minutes until you run out, get an usher, and the
you can be sitting in assigned seating when there's 20 people in the cinema.
Yeah.
There's so many things that it's like you don't want people to come. I just don't understand how cinemas function this way.
We should cite positive examples, because when I was talking about this, I was thinking specifically of, say, places like the IFI and the Lighthouse.
Yeah,
the thing I absolutely adore about the Lighthouse is that they've put their cinemas underground, so nobody has any phone signal. So even if they take it out, they put it away again.
But I mean, even then, like I've been there. They organize parties.
They do festivals. Yeah, they really celebrate the culture of cinema.
Yeah, it's a pillar of the local community. I remember when I was in town doing business, like, you know, signing the deeds to get my mortgage, I sort of went into the Lighthouse to see what was on, went to see Steve Jobs, and it was a parent and child screening. And that was just, like, that's a really wonderful thing to do.
Reaching out to the community, knowing that people can't always get in, and trying to accommodate that.
Yeah, and like, really, I feel like that's an experience. I have people I work with, like, and I don't work in the film sector, but people I work with who won't go to the cinema unless the film they want to see is in the Lighthouse.
Yeah,
I feel like that's
which is why I'm going to see A Quiet Place next week. Because now it's opening up.
I'd be exactly the same.
I'm not willing to sit through, first of all, 30 minutes of trailers, and then 2 hours of very badly behaved people who aren't policed.
Yeah, I feel like if you were to take the money that you were investing in 4DX and instead hire an
additional staff and pay them properly, and you might get a better cinema experience and more people going to it. I mean, it seems obvious to me, but I mean,
there are all other sorts of ways to invest this. The Triskel in Cork does a really nice thing where there's a sort of fixed price where you get a meal in the restaurant next door. You get your parking at a nearby car park,
and you get your film ticket.
It makes a night of it. People have to, they still have to do, you know, the drama, sorting out the babysitter, but then you arrive and that's your night. Yeah, exactly.
Like, I mean, because that's the thing. It's the cost. I mean, I remember somebody making the facetious point online that, you know, all film reviewers, before they offer a star rating for a movie, should have to arrange a babysitter, find car parking, and, you know, have to pay in queue for their tickets in order to properly rate the experience. I know. I appreciated the point that was being made, which is an acknowledgement that, you know, going to the cinema is sometimes hard for a particular
people.
I think
when people bash Netflix, I think they should bear that in mind.
Yeah.
Because that's a lifesaver for a hell of a lot of people.
Well,
that A, don't want to go to the big
multiplex,
or B, that there aren't any cinemas around them.
Yeah, don't have access to those films, so yeah, I would agree with that sort of wholeheartedly.
So get a bloody grip, Cineworld. That's the final word.
That's what we're going with here.
Because I will not be into 4DX cinema at all.
Myself and Jay, we should mount a fact-finding expedition to go and see Avengers Infinity War in 4DX.
Come on, if you get me to see Avengers Infinity War,
I'll get your tickets.
No, I'm not doing it.
I'll cover your tickets.
I really want this to happen.
Stop it, Rowan. Don't encourage this.
Come on, people, tweet at Jay and let him know.
We'll
start a Kickstarter to get it working.
Hashtag Jay hates Avengers.
That's another question. How much does it cost? I presume to get more to be distracted from a film by irritants, does it cost you more? I'm curious if I imagine it's like, in any way, shape, form, it should be cheaper.
It should be distracting.
Like, it should be a point for less.
You mean, like, because the seat isn't actually physically fixed in the ground, basically.
I went to things like that in Disneyland in the 90s. I was less than 10 and it felt hokey.
There's an arcade on Cable Street that has it. It cost you a couple of quid. It's like a Chinese arcade. Go to Cable Street.
There was one in O'Connell Street as well. But I mean, I will be the cheap and tacky one and say that,
you're going, aren't you?
No, I'm saying that I appreciate that in a theme park. I think that, you know,
yeah, that's not sure. That's
but you know, that's a theme park.
If you don't like theme parks, you shouldn't be there. Like that's our nonsense level. Like that's, theme parks are great.
I can't actually get access to see the price right.
It's all right, but we'll find out. My God, I'll tell you.
We suspect that it will be very.
We
very
know
expensive.
It'll be expensive.
The prices for tickets there are already like 13, 14 euro, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, they're not cheap.
They're not cheap at all, even if you have the discount online. Finally, news-wise, the Tribeca Film Festival is happening this weekend in New York.
Bobby Vero and co.
Yeah, and they're doing, obviously, they have Scarface as their big Al Pacino retrospective going on as well.
Hoo-wah!
Hoo-wah, for example. Oh, their opening night is they're showing Westworld, the first premiere of the second season, which sort of... continues to blur the line.
That tells you where we are now. Our season is premiering its opening nights of film festivals. And you know what? Fine.
Can I ask a question, right? Tribeca's on, right? Does anybody really care about the Tribeca Film Festival? And I say that in the way that I never hear anybody about this film premiered at Tribeca, but you hear about Toronto, about Venice, about...
Tribeca is sort of second tier.
Does it get second ones?
It's not Venice, it's not Toronto.
It's not, is it?
You got to keep in mind that you... Gotta keep in mind, now I want to be very sensitive in how I phrase this. It is in some ways an upgrade from other film festivals.
Mm-hmm.
The point where, for example, there was a movie that was supposed to premiere at the Audi Dublin International Film Festival, which was rescheduled to appear in Tribeca, which is a deception.
This is the...
The one starring Rachel McAdams and Rachel Weisz, isn't it? Am I thinking
that
about
was
the
right?
We were speaking about this last week.
Yeah. So that one is premiering at Tribeca. So that one is a step up for that one, for example. But yeah, there is an element of it isn't a big.
But it's New York, so you know it's
it's glam. You'll get a photo op with
Robert De Niro as well. Yeah,
fine. That's fine. I never hear anything like what I always hear when the Tribeca Film Festival is on. I don't hear about it for 365 days on Sunday. It's like fresh from its amazing success at the Tribeca. It's already Sundance, isn't it? Like, I mean, you know.
It began its Oscar run.
Has anything began its Oscar run at the Tribeca? I'm curious to know.
Probably.
So there's Karen Gillan's directorial writing debut is also premiering there. So I'm actually quite interested in checking that out.
Okay,
But yeah, I think there's a wealth of stuff there. There's the usual, they have like panels on Time's Up and Vior and stuff, which has become the new festival circuit thing.
Vior is just in every festival.
That is, along with airing television episodes.
I know they do things. I know the one thing I do like about Tribeca, and this is De Niro pull, and presumably with the Scarface thing, they had was it Goodfellas last year, the anniversary restoration?
I think
they had Godfather before that, so they do this kind of, and they get all the cast back, and
that's
a real splashy
like
kind of thing. Yeah. I can see that, and if I was in New York, you bet your ass I'd be grabbing a ticket for that, but not for anything else.
Cool. And closer to home, then, we should probably mention, we discussed it last week, but just to refresh your memory, the Dublin Science Fiction Film Festival is happening
which
next
we're
weekend.
We're hoping to quote this.
I have got a ticket for Let the Corpses 10, which
I'm hoping to get a ticket for that, and I should be there.
Perfect. And you can check out their schedule online. So with that in mind, then, let's take a look at the weekly top 10.
Oh, do let's.
Drum roll.
Drum roll, please.
I'm not doing a drum roll.
You're not doing a drum roll.
I'm not a performing monkey, Darren.
In the mood. Somehow, the top 10 is where you really shine, Jay.
Yeah, it is. I've seen so many.
At number 10, Isle of Dogs.
Which I'll get to this week, probably.
Next week. I'm really want that scene.
This is the most like Jay and Ronan friendly film in here.
If this is number 10, though, we're going to see it next week.
Yeah,
we'll
be talking about this in the films you watched this week.
Oh, you bet you.
I really, really liked it. And number 9, Pitbull, which is another, it's a Polish film, actually.
This one is limited screen in kind of a special showing.
Nearly 40 grand.
This seems to happen, I don't know, quite regularly. But
yeah, no, it happens.
You've seen it pop in quite a lot. Yeah, that's obviously our enormous Polish population are real cinema goers and glad to see Polish films given exhibition here.
Yeah, and I mean it's like those live events as well in the cinema. It's a reminder of the cinema as a communal experience almost, which is
a reminder of the communities that we're not necessarily serving all of the time.
Yeah, or that you aren't even aware of until you discuss it in this list.
Yeah, I know you get occasional Indian films that show the kind of Bollywood stuff in the city world, and
they do
get
incredibly well in the UK.
Yeah, you do, they really do.
At number 8, Duck Duck Goose.
That's going to stay, isn't it?
Film of the year, I think.
If this doesn't sweep the Oscars, I mean, if this doesn't join One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest as a bird-themed, 5-Oscar-sweeping film, I think, we need to desperately reevaluate where we are as a culture. At number 7, Ready Player One.
Yeah.
Jay?
No.
I have not seen this because it's Ready Player One.
If I were to buy you a ticket to see this in 4DX, could we make this happen?
Darren, I will kill you if you keep down this road.
All right. Liked it grand. It's better than it should be. It's possibly the best adaptation that it's possible to make of the source novel.
Okay.
Which is damning with the faintest of praise. Mm. And doesn't exactly make you guys want to rush out to see it. Very Spielbergian, very energetic. Mm.
You've read the source, have you?
I've read bits of the source. As much of the source as I could stomach.
I read one page.
I
feel I've seen the film and read the book now.
Yeah, it's
enough for me.
It's this thing you like encountering this other thing you like, but this other thing you like is even better. Do you remember that thing that you like? Oh yeah, I remember the thing that I see.
I don't really go well with nostalgia for the most part.
Certain types of
nostalgia. I remember the '80s in Ireland. I don't, there's no nostalgia here. I can assure you.
I'm tolerant of certain kinds of nostalgia. I think that the nostalgia embodied by what we were talking earlier with the Prince, mm-hmm. I think that's good. That's sure. Grand.
Yeah.
I think that nostalgia for nostalgia's sake
is not
necessarily
I agree.
And good of itself. Love, Simon, which I saw last night.
That's number six.
In there, number six. Which is a really good showing for it. It is
indeed. It's earned 260,000 euro to date.
Good indication for word of mouth, and I'm not
surprised. Only 21% drop, which is pretty strong.
Yeah, talking about the idea of underserved audiences, especially at multiplex level, this is something that, there's a huge audience for.
That's great.
And it's really great to see it doing well.
Yeah,
you were a big fan?
I really, really liked it. It's incredibly charming.
Yeah, it really is. And isn't it hilariously funny? There are moments where I laughed so loud.
It is.
It's got a really sharp script.
Yeah, and Josh Duhamel, who looks like somebody somehow cloned Timothy Olyphant and Johnny Knoxville, and produced somebody who can act, which is no, I like Timothy Olyphant.
I remember there was
a while when Josh Duhamel was popping up in romantic comedies, and I was like, have they smartened up Johnny Knoxville? I feel like we finally passed that moment.
I'm glad to hear.
He gets a really interesting role because the kind of crux of the film's idea. It's a film that in a lot of ways presses the, maybe not the need, but the value of coming out.
Yeah.
And he gets the interesting role where it's not easy and shiny and sunny, It's not an immediate, I love you, son, hug. There's a difficulty to that relationship. Yeah. And it's navigated really well. Because I think it's crucial that a film like this doesn't come along and say, everything will be fantastic.
Everybody will be,
there will be absolutely. It's a dangerous reality for a lot of markets, showing in.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're right, you pointed out last week that this is a very middle class, very privileged in some ways person coming out, but it still acknowledges that it's not easy, it never will be.
It does have really interesting representations of race in there. I think overwhelmingly the most interesting characters in the film, for me at least, were all black characters. They're, a lot of Simon's friends and the other queer character who's kind of pointed out to a lot, and the drama teacher who is fantastically funny.
Yeah.
This comes through the film like a whirlwind.
This is another man in 12 films I'd see this week.
very, very long.
It's exhausting. How do people do this?
It's very exhausting not watching these movies. It weighs on you.
In fairness, I've watched one movie this week. Like, I could have watched like six of these. I'm never going on holidays again. That's the lesson.
Keep in mind that 2 weeks ago, the film companies unleashed 12 different films.
Madness. That was rude of them.
Stop making so many good films.
We have very few days.
At number five, Blockers, which is perhaps not quite as great as Love, Simon, but is still a surprisingly pro-feminist, progressive sex farce.
I'm seeing a lot of positive response coming into this. Yeah, people are really engaging with it.
It is. It's really, really charming. It is the best version of the film that it could be without not being the film that it could be, or that it wants to be, which is remarkable. Mm. It's confident, it's assured, it's makes really great use of its cast. Like John Cena, for example, who is not the greatest actor of his generation. But the film understands innately that he is very good at giving reaction shots.
Yeah.
Perhaps owing to the pantomime quality of WWE. Not F anymore.
No,
not F since about 97, I think.
I am hip and with it. One of the best gags in Blockers hinges entirely on a close-cropped frame of John Cena's eyebrows and face reacting to a visual placed in front of him. There's a very good understanding.
I'm more and more tempted by this.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's. I'm great. I should just keep selling Roman films he doesn't want to go and see. Don't worry, there'll be another one coming up very, very shortly.
Oh, dear.
At number four, from the studio that brought you Get Out, Truth or Dare.
Which, in some territories, is literally being released as Blumhouse's Truth or Dare, right?
No, it is. It's the studio as auteur, which is interesting. That's a really yeah. interesting. It's no longer, because remember, past couple of years, we've seen a lot of From the Producer of.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's
it's weird to see From the Production Company that brought
Well, they're owning it now, aren't they?
Yeah, they really are. Yeah. They're going with them. I mean,
although it's got terrible reviews, hasn't it?
It has got terrible reviews. Well, that's why putting Get Out above the name in whatever way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm waiting for From the guy whose sister is the dog walker of the producer of Get Out.
A man who once read the novel that The Shining was based on.
Yeah. Truth or Dare is, interestingly enough, based on a dare, apparently.
Dare you to make a film, really?
That's exactly. Can you make a film around the game Truth or Dare? And
the answer is technically
legally speaking, yes.
You can. Whether
But you should.
Yeah, there's the Jeff Goldblum effect from Jurassic Park. Because you were so busy worrying whether you could do a thing, you never stopped to ask if you should.
Yeah.
Line has such mileage.
At number three, finally tumbling off the top spot, it's Peter Rabbit.
It is, agreed.
Yeah. I can't argue with your titling.
That it is.
Has it taken an obscene amount of money?
Yes.
Yes, it's earned more than Black Panther.
Good lord!
It's taken 3 million quid.
Ireland, in this country, that's almost one euro for every man, woman, and child in this country.
No, there's the film board's budget.
Took your children and held them hostage.
He did not get my money though, thankfully.
Yeah.
Jay, what if I were to pay to take you to
in smell-o-vision?
You can really smell the carrots.
Yes, indeed.
But yeah, at number two, Rampage, which is basically,
this is the other one you saw growing in the last
one.
This is your beloved, which notably you'll see it's, happen.
When I say when I say
the
beloved,
concept.
Yeah, when I did beloved. Say beloved, I did open with it's terrible, but.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a movie which starts as Kong Skull Island and ends as Godzilla, the 2014 version, and suffers horribly from the tonal stuff.
Yeah.
It's a movie which has a 9/11 climax, but with quips. It transitions from a site of first responders pulling victims out of the rubble in slow motion to a giant albino orangutan making the universal hand gesture for sex.
Oh.
It's all over the shop.
Oh, hello.
And Ronan is back in the game.
I'm exhausted. Just hearing about it.
But yeah, it's a.
I feel like I've seen it.
No, you haven't.
No, yeah. I probably can't.
It's a movie that works best when it's earnest. It isn't always earnest. It doesn't always work. It does have a really, and the thing is, it has a really mean sense of humor because of that dissonance. Mm. So you have this sort of goofy, playful, earnest, like. The Rock is a guy who doesn't like people, so his best friend is a giant monstrous albino gorilla, versus, okay, we're doing the climax of Man of Steel.
And it
doesn't work, and it leads to this really horrible, mean-spirited sense of humor at the climax, where it gets rid of its two human villain characters in ways which the film thinks is funny.
Oh, no.
But which just seem malicious. And these are like cardboard cutout 80s capitalists. Like, these are characters who are not
meant to like.
To them. Yeah, and you feel like the film treats them unfairly.
And you should never feel that way about capitalists. Like,
80s,
never.
80s, like, Robocop knockoff baddies played by Maylin Ackerman and Jake Lacey, of all people as well.
Okay.
In thankless tasks. At number one, I think we can call it an honest to goodness event film, A Quiet Place.
That's amazing. That's what's number one.
That's astonishing.
Yeah. I remember, the moment that I realized that this was, inverted commas, an event, was the moment when I was traveling on the Lewis on Tuesday evening, and two women in their 50s were talking about going to see it.
Oh, wow. It's pushed beyond any, kind of well beyond any...
Well beyond any sort of imagined horror sort of threshold, sort of broken
out. We've moved on beyond demographics now. Like.
Yeah, which is remarkable. Like, and again, it's a low-budget horror film from Paramount.
Yeah.
It's
up 13% in the second week.
It's second week.
Jeez, that's really good.
And that's really phenomenal word of mouth. That's just like
And it has, I've noticed, you know, among my own friends, people talking about it constantly, not necessarily having seen
as
yet,
you mentioned,
the clear indication that they're going to
see it. Yeah, well, it is, it's going to be in the Lighthouse, and like...
We'll be there.
And that's a good indication that the Lighthouse, which traditionally caters toward more arthouse fare, sees a fiscal opportunity here. So
yeah.
Let's open it up.
Yeah, and I mean, it is worth noting, again, to tie back into what we were talking about, like the cinematic, like tradition and experience... A Quiet Place is a movie that lends itself to that, in that it makes you complicit.
Yeah.
So we talk about this where we talk about the individualizing experience. Audiences are reportedly quiet while watching A Quiet Place.
Maybe it'll train.
Which is remarkable.
I'm really interested to see it. I think it's an interesting move from Krasinski because it indicates to me that he probably understands his own strength as an actor, which, based on The Office, is reaction shots.
Yeah.
He's great at them.
They should put himself and John Cena in a movie just sitting opposite each other on a desk. There. People, Irish Film Board, give me my financing now and we are all
set.
Can
I have a question about it? Paramount did a studio that were down under behinds, right?
Yeah.
They had only Mission Impossible and something else.
Bumblebee.
Yeah, and now this has come out of nowhere to some degree in terms of box office.
Yeah.
To make the money, which I imagine some executives going, oh Christ, I could have just saved my job. The guy that created this one.
This is along the line of, this was sort of the high, was it Brad Grey? These are the high concept movies that I think Grey sort of greenlit along with Annihilation, for example, which Paramount couldn't get rid of quickly enough. And to be honest, the Cloverfield paradox as well, which it was right to get rid of. But you have to wonder now, if Paramount had put the effort into advertising Annihilation, because it had no advertising budget to stake, could word of mouth have done it? Because it seems to have done reasonably well on Netflix over here. It seems to have done quite well on social media.
Good, okay. I would imagine. No word of mouth in the States as well.
It did relatively well. It made something like 60% of its budget back, like with no advertising.
Yeah,
okay.
And again, this is a female-led holiday, a female-led sort of science fiction horror movie released in March.
Yeah.
So you're wondering, if you look at the success of A Quiet Place, the issue isn't some Paramount executive going, "Hoot, I saved my job," but going,
"Could
we have done something like that with Annihilation?" Because it's really, really, and it's great to see, because again, it's a low budget original, or film that, it's a horror movie that isn't based on an existing property that was made cost-effectively and has turned into a phenomenon.
And it's going to make an absolute fortune, overall. Like, it's had a
good increase in its second.
I was going to say,
it's a really good indication.
Good on them. I'm really looking forward to seeing it. I hope we catch the Lions this weekend.
Perfect. All right, then, we'll move on to the new releases. Opening this week, The Cured, which is the Irish zombie film.
I really like the look of this. I'm looking forward to it.
It's quite good. I saw it at the Audi Dublin Film Festival a little while ago. It's good. It's solid. It feels like it should probably be more of a television series than a movie. It's got a wonderful, wonderful eye concept, which is basically, it's a zombie apocalypse after the zombie apocalypse.
Mm-hmm.
So they've imagined, for example, they've said basically, well, look, we've cured the zombie apocalypse, and how do we reintegrate people who, up until last week were chewing each other's faces off in a literal sense. And so you get this sort of like wonderful use of zombie allegorical storytelling for stuff that could apply to coming back into life after prison, but could also apply to a very specific Irish story of like reintegration after the Troubles and stuff like that. And it's got a lot of this rich stuff going on underneath it. It's got a really good cast. Tom Vaughan Lawler was meant to play he plays a zombie here, a recovering zombie, but he was meant to play like a vampire. He's got that real horror movie sort of unsettling presence, which is very, very effective.
Great name, isn't it? Sorry, I'm a recovering zombie. Yeah. Oh, it's been a tough week.
Yeah, I'm off the red stuff.
Yeah.
But the issue is though that it's got maybe too many ideas going on in it, and it sort of has to cram them all in together, and so stuff gets lost in the shuffle, if you'll pardon the pun. And inevitably it builds towards the kind of climax that a movie like this all but demands, but which isn't entirely feasible on an Irish film budget.
Yeah, see, this we were talking about things that the way kind of RT seem to be gatekeepers towards kind of TV being made properly in Ireland and stuff, like in terms of independent ideas and stuff. And we're talking about, I think Niall might have mentioned that Cure would have made a great TV show.
It would make a fantastic
TV
series, and you would sell it overseas.
Would we commit budgets to something that would really need a budget?
Yeah.
I mean, Love Hate's probably the only thing we've ever committed.
And even
so, a relatively sizable budget.
And even then, this would need several times.
But like, so you're looking at co-production anyway. But like, surely it's something that could be pulled off.
It is. And I mean, like, the film is quite good. I really enjoyed the film. And if you're interested in horror movies and if you like high concepts, go for it. It's very worth checking out.
All right.
Otherwise opening, there's Every Day, which is directed by Michael Soucy, starring Mariabella. And I know next to nothing
I have no idea what this is.
Yeah.
A shy teenager falls for someone who transforms into another person every day.
That's teenagers, isn't it?
Doctor Who, isn't it?
Yeah. Doctor Who slash teenagers. Yeah. I have nothing. I've heard nothing about this, which and I'm not aware of any screenings released by Vertigo. So that, okay, that makes sense.
There you go.
Also releasing this week is the Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Pie Society.
Which, you know, just give the Oscar now.
It's some character complaining using an article about the naming of films in the Irish Times. It's not.
Well, people keep going on about how it's a terrible name. Yeah, it's
memorable. This is the only reason. About it 2 years ago. Did we ever see that film that was called? What the hell are you talking about? No,
trust me, as somebody who's seen the film,
of course
that's the best way that this film will be remembered.
Yeah.
I'm not a.
Surely you've been making a good film is a better idea. No?
Yeah, well, you've got to work with what you have, Jay.
Oh, well, okay.
I just like the idea of this whizzing past people on Dublin bus, them going, the what the
heck? Wait for the next bus to be the second.
Yeah, and just sort of catch half the name each time and sort of stitch it together.
Yeah, I do like that, actually.
The logo looks like it was made to go on this Keep Calm and Carry On bag as well. Yeah. Noticed that. It's grand. It's comfort blanket filmmaking. It's very much aimed at the silver
English
euro
thing, isn't it? That makes money.
That
best exotic market to film.
That sort of stuff. It's like a
big market.
It's a
step down from
that.
Maybe a step up from what was that one where Timothy Spall plays a lovable rogue who lives on a barge. On your feet or something like that.
Yeah,
finding your feet. Finding your feet. So it's maybe a step up from that, a step down.
I missed that completely. I've never heard of it.
That was the one that had the strange cinema ads where it was Celia Imrie saying, "Come to the cinema and see this film."
Experience group, yeah.
What's going on?
Yeah, you can't.
It's really strange.
You can't match the group experience of watching the film.
It wasn't a trailer for the film. It was Celia Imrie saying, "Come and see the film, please, in a cinema."
Yeah,
which is that very
very aggressive. Yeah,
very weird.
There's no point seeing a film if you don't see it here.
Netflix is.
Yeah. It's also a very weird ad because it doesn't make a case for you seeing that particular film.
Film in general. Go to a quiet place. Why not?
Yeah, that's it. I think it was around the time Black Panther was out as well. I was like,
made a fortune from the over 60s.
Yeah, demographic. But yeah, the Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Society.
Is there much of a focus in the film, this is important, on potato peel pies? Because that sounds gross.
No, it comes up very briefly. The ingredients are discussed.
That doesn't sound appetizing.
No.
At all.
No, I like potatoes.
I love potatoes.
I'll
eat a shepherd's pie till the cows come home.
It's basically, you know, this author goes to Guernsey after the Second World War, begins investigating a mystery involving the Literary and Potato Peel Pie Society. And basically uncovers all these dark secrets lurking beneath the surface of the island. Except because this is the movie that it is, you are constantly reassured that those secrets could never be
dark.
Not that dark. Yeah. It's like those dark secrets are how awesome these people are. And they're modest about it. There's a lot of that running through the film. It's very gentle. It's a film that you could show your grandmother and she'd never raise an eyebrow.
I think my grandmother had a better taste than this.
Almost feel myself falling asleep.
Yeah, just listening to it. And then otherwise we have The Leisure Seeker, which is Helen Mirren and Donald Sutherland. I've seen ads for this.
I've heard mixed things.
Very little about it. It's a runaway couple going on an unforgettable journey in their faithful old RV they call the Leisure Seeker.
It's one of those films that every actress in America seems to get to at a certain age. They get to do an RV across the country.
Get to be paid to do a trip across the country.
You can get around. It's like the walk in the woods and various other things like that.
Go take a holiday and bring a camera with you.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, Hitchcock would just build them for the holiday afterwards and then write a film about it.
Sure.
My favorite one is, I think Anthony Hopkins used to fly to New York and build them for the Cadillac trip that he'd take across the States. Studio accounting is fantastic.
It is.
And then otherwise, there's also Let the Sunshine In. Which is Juliette Binoche.
The new Claire Denis film, which is something.
This is an interesting one because I'm woefully behind Claire Denis, right?
I'm
trying to see one film. But I've seen, she's a very vociferous fan base, right?
Yeah.
So I've seen wow, 5 stars for this. And then I've seen some people who are also a fan of hers going, No.
Don't let the sunshine in.
So you've seen this, right?
Yeah, I've seen this. I'm like you, I haven't seen nearly as much as I'd like. I've seen Trouble Every Day and Bastards is the extent of my experience with. Yeah, I didn't like Bastards very much.
That was okay.
But
I know there's 2 or 3 that I really need to see that people talk about.
They're an awful lot. I need to see. Trouble Every Day, I adore. I think it's a fantastic film. Let the Sunshine In, I'm not crazy about. It is incredibly French, which isn't a bad thing.
It's got Jared Depardieu in it.
It does.
But it is incredibly
French. It does. Yeah. Jared Depardieu turns up extremely late in the film and gets a really interesting scene. It's, I can
but
very much...
about the filming.
I can very much see what Binoche was attracted to here. It's that kind of role that she really throws herself into. It's really, really funny at a lot of points, but it's also deeply dramatic and deals with a lot of deep, dark character moments. And I think the balance it tries to strike between them is something it never really gets to, okay. Which is maybe partially the point of it. It wants to kind of characterize how people flip and flop and have extreme mood swings. It's really interesting. I may go and see it again. It had that effect on me where I sort of walked out thinking that was okay. It was really interesting, but more interesting than, you know, entertaining at any point.
Yeah.
I do think I'll go back to it. It's often very funny, but Binoche is an absolute marvel as ever.
She's one of the best actors of her generation. Mm-hmm.
I don't think it really hangs together as well as I wish it would, because there's a really interesting film in there, but this isn't really it, I think.
And then finally, a film which I'd heard nothing about, but reading its description, I am all over. Wildling is out this weekend, starring Brad Dourif, Liv Tyler. It's a horror movie about a blossoming teenager uncovering the dark secret behind her traumatic childhood.
That sounds like literally every horror of a certain budget.
Is that the extent of the plot synopsis?
Yep, Brad Dourif. Brad Dourif, ladies and gentlemen, and Liv Tyler.
Well, who directed it?
Fritz Boon.
Ah, Fritz.
Yes, back again. We know him so well.
That's literally that plot sounds like every horror film.
That is so nondescript. What are they doing? Which suggests maybe it's absolutely full of like twists that they just
can't. Or it's just all the cliches.
Yeah.
But again, Brad Dourif and Liv Tyler.
Yeah, that's
in a low budget, unannounced horror film.
I presume they're the parents there, right? Are the Brad parents?
No,
they're a teenager.
Brad Dourif is cracking on at this age.
I would love to see Brad Dourif playing a teenager discovering his secret heritage.
Me too. A fine actor.
But anyway, so that wraps it up. We'll be back next week and we'll be discussing some stuff that may be coming out. Maybe there's a big movie coming out that Jay can watch in 4DX before we do the podcast, but we'll never know.
Is that Infinity War next week?
Yeah.
Is there next week?
Yeah.
That happens very fast.
I still have Black Panther.
Which is now no longer in the top 10.
Jay,
you can't see it. Can
Jay,
yeah.
I will pay for you to go see it in 4DX.
I stopped there. If I have to put a press release on Twitter later to say that I've never seen anything in 4DX.
How does this 4DX thing work? So the water that they spray or what? And is it just water that they spray?
It's like water, it's scents, it's like...
Okay.
Back in the day, you used to have smell-o-vision.
Yeah, who coordinates this? Who decides what's released when? Is it on a cinema by cinema basis or a rogue cinema employee?
We have the console here. It's like the DJ. It's like that you get to mix them as well. It's like
are the Russo brothers off in Hollywood being like, release the lavender?
Yeah, right now, whenever Thanos appears on screen, we want the rich scent of lavender.
It's the smell of ScarJo's hair.
Yeah. But I do like the... Well, you know that when they did silent films, many of the silent films didn't come with original scores. They
the piano players just improvised.
Yeah, so
I'm
now
fantastic.
Imagining... Yeah, I'm now
I would watch a lot of films like that.
Yeah. It's great. You get them at a festival sometimes that you'll get a pianist to just come along and improv. And it's fantastic.
But I'm imagining the Smell-O-Vision 4DX version of that, where it's just Bob.
Somebody behind with a cheese grater.
I got the bucket.
Yeah. Okay, damn it, I need those lilies in there now.
What film would you really like to watch in Smell-O-Vision?
These are the questions. Chocolat, probably, I don't know. Off the top of my head, just because I'm thinking about Juliette Binoche.
Delicatessen?
Yeah, probably something involving lots of food.
Julia.
Oh, that would actually work out quite well, I think, yeah. Mostly a food film. probably not a zombie horror film, I would have to say.
No.
Well, yeah, I've obviously seen it. It's awful. Awful. Bad cinema world. Bad cinema world.
Guys, tweet at Jay Coyle and let him know that you are very interested in his journalistic exploration of what his 4DX experience is.
We need 4,000 words on this.
Yeah, I think we could
God
do this.
Damn
you know,
to hell,
you know those features that they do where it's like, I ate like this fictional character for a week, which seems like a big trend at the moment. I feel like Jay...
This goes against everything I believe in. As a journalist. I'm seeing the Player Penal Society pie film in 4DX.
The beautiful scent of potato peel.
Yeah. Tell me you wouldn't read a 400-word article from J, or 4,000-word article from Jay on the Ant Experience.
Lord.
I mean, we can make room in the next issue of Sinéirin for it. But anyway,
set the pace, spread.
If that doesn't appeal to you, where can you find you guys online, Jay?
I'd be moaning on Twitter at Jay Coyle.
Get me on Twitter at Baron Ronan.
I co-host a podcast, The 250, and this week, to mark the passing of Milos Forman, we have Phil Bagnall, who is almost a guest on this podcast this evening, on discussing Amadeus. And then the week after, marking the passing of War of the Urmi, we'll be talking about Full Metal Jacket. Until then, take it easy. We'll be back next week, and see you soon. Bye, guys.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
I never forget the first moment when I walked in Kyo Cinema. I was hooked from there on.